Blog Talk Radio.
Chatting with Sherry is presented by the Writers and Illustrators of the Future, which has been providing a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for their creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today's show, we're going to have one of the winners of the Writers and Illustrators of the Future contest, which is sort of shocking because they are also our advertisers. Woo! Who knew? Anyway, his name is Andrew Dyskel. I hope I didn't mess up your name. And he is, this is a first-time writer, and he just got handed the book. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to the show, and I'm sorry if I messed up your name.
Oh, hi, Sherry. It's good to be here. And it's Dutch. There's just no help for it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can kind of relate to that. My name has been pronounced pretty much with letters and vowels in it that isn't in it. So I can relate.
Yeah, okay, now I feel like I have to take a shot at it. Rabinowitz?
Actually, you said it perfectly.
Oh, okay.
I've had Robotskowitz, Grabinski, Grabinski, Rotchkin. I mean, like I said, letters that aren't and vowels that aren't even in there. my dad started giving his first name. Well, actually, his middle name, he hated his first name. His first name when we went to restaurants because he just couldn't stand to hear the name butchered any longer.
Well, the funny thing is, my first name, of course, is Andrew, and my parents have occasionally apologized to me for that because they didn't realize it was going to be such a hugely popular name in my generation, and there were so many Andrews running around my undergraduate institution that my friends all started calling me Dykstall. Many of them still do, so everyone was kind of stuck with a difficult name because otherwise they'd say, hey, Andrew, and, you know, half the cafeteria would look up.
Well, that's funny because when I was in junior high, they used to call me Rabbi.
Ah, yeah.
Rabinowitz, Rabbi. It is really weird, but that's what they did. But Sherry was pretty. My mom thought she did spell it differently, but there was like at least 8 Sherrys in my class when I was in elementary school, junior high school, high school. There was always several of us.
Well, at least you could tell each other apart on the written work.
Mostly, yeah. Actually, I do know a Sherry now who actually spells her name the same way I do, but 90% don't. In fact, when I was a kid, you know those little things that they give you that you can put on the back of your bicycle, the little license plate? Well, we could never find my name.
That's disappointing. So is there still that hole from your childhood, or do you now have a vanity plate for your car that says Sherry, you know, Sherri?
I really don't want the world to know what my first name is, strangers and stuff.
Fair enough.
I mean, when I'm driving, it's fine on the show and stuff like that, but when I'm driving my car, I don't want somebody to, I get cut off or they cut me off and, hey, you know, beep, 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 and I'm like, nah, I don't really need them to know my name.
Right.
So one of the things I like to ask writers is, when did you begin writing? Did you do it as a child? Did you start later? How did you start?
Well, I was actually a bit of a rough essayist growing up. I was homeschooled, and my poor mother invested a tremendous amount of work in getting my essay writing up to par. But I didn't really do very much experimenting with fiction in middle school or high school. It wasn't really until I got to undergrad that I started playing around with that. And so I wrote some, you know, spectacularly dreadful stories in college, and one that I have very little recollection of writing because I had a fever of about 104 while I was working on it that won an English department prize for their annual competition, and that was a moment that convinced me that maybe I should, you know, keep doing this, at least as a hobby, and keep it on the back burner and see what I can eventually make of it.
Oh, that is really interesting that you don't remember writing it.
Yeah, that was a
third state.
That was a really, really long few weeks.
Oh, that's really weird. I mean, I remember the first story that ever got any kind of recognition was sort of a mistake to me, but I remember writing it. I was in fifth or sixth grade, and my teacher wrote a sentence on the chalkboard, and she said, write a story for it, and it should be at least two paragraphs. Well, 6 pages later, I turned mine in.
Oh, that's well, and you can just imagine your teacher going home at the end of the night with everything that needs grading, and like, why is the stack of paper noticeably heavier than usual? Oh.
Yeah, exactly.
It's Sherry's fault, yep.
Yeah, it's my fault. But it was so funny because she loved it. It was a little myth. I wrote my own mythology, and she just thought, wow, this is really cute. That was my first acknowledgement as a writer. That was one of the teachers I had that was really encouraging. There were some teachers that weren't, but this one was a great teacher.
And that can make such a difference. It really can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, encouragement, and even if the student isn't perfect doing whatever they're doing, I think the teacher would be astonished at the encouragement would bring out if they said nice things instead of tearing things apart. That's my experience, at least as a student.
Right. Well, it's a real challenge. Yeah, I've been on both sides of the desk. I used to teach high school English, and it's a real challenge to be able to find the time and the emotional energy to give the kind of feedback that students really need to develop and prosper as writers. I mean, one of the reasons that the way writing is frequently taught is so counterproductive is because the curriculum ends up skewed more toward what's easy to teach and easy to grade rather than what's necessarily going to produce a really effective prose stylist or even someone who's good at critically and analytically thinking through a problem or a prompt or a historical situation or what have you.
Yeah, yes, I see that. I mean, and I actually experienced something that when I was a kid, one of the classes I had and I loved was, we had like everything class. We didn't have separation until I was in junior high school. And we had history. And one of the things, I loved English, I loved history, I liked all kinds of music. But I loved history. I still do. But one of the things I noticed was it didn't tell as much as I learned from my parents, the books they gave me, the television shows. And I got in trouble once. I actually got sent to the principal's office. Because, well, there was, but I wasn't really in trouble. He just didn't want to deal with me. I was a big Bewitched fan. This tells you how long ago it was. And there was an episode of Bewitched in Salem, and I just love those episodes, the Salem episodes. But in our book, it was two sentences about Salem. And I just asked a simple question. I said, why aren't we talking more about Salem? It was part of the same period that we're talking about because it's not in the curriculum. And I said, but can't we have a talk or a discussion? And he just lost his temper and sent me to the principal's room because I dared question him.
Yeah, well, it's scary going off the curriculum because then you don't have that to protect you from, you know, 20 inquisitive students. And inquisitive students, they're the best kind, and they're terrifying. So there you have it.
Oh, my principal was sweet. But I was in tears because one of the kids, as I was leaving, said that I was going to get expelled, which was expelled. And I was like in tears. I was hysterical. The principal didn't even know what I was there for like 5 minutes because he couldn't understand because I was so hysterical. So he called my dad, and my dad came in from, he was a salesman, so he could come, and he came in, and it took him a few minutes, even though he knew me so well, to get it. But that's, I think that's why it's such a strong memory. It was such a big deal.
Well, what's that great line from the first Harry Potter book where Hermione is telling off the other leads that we all could have been killed, or worse, expelled?
That's a great line.
The end of the world.
Yeah. Well, for any student, it is.
Oh,
and I
absolutely.
Didn't even know what it meant yet. I was a little kid. I didn't even know what expelled was.
Oh yeah, it's the end of the world. There is. You're just cast into the formless void. Yep.
Yep. It's so funny. Do you have any favorite writers that inspired you? I mean, is Joe Rawlings? I mean, you're probably not a child when Joe wrote the books, but was she one of your inspirations?
I did read those. Actually, my dad read the first couple of them aloud to my sister and me, which was fantastic. But yeah, I mean the Harry Potter books are still kind of the contemporary gold standard for YA fiction, and they're pretty impressive in what she was able to pull off. In terms of the books that kind of shaped me a bit more as a writer, rather than books that allowed me to conceal some of my social awkwardness with my peers by having a common subject of conversation. I've read a lot of Cormac McCarthy and thoroughly enjoy the way that he's able to play around with literature and history. I grew up on Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, some Ray Bradbury, some Heinlein, some of those old school science fiction greats. Came a little later into Ursula Le Guin, and her prose is just absolutely fantastic. So there are a lot of authors that I've digested and tried to pull out the elements that could work for me. But I mean, honestly, the best thing about all these books is just the way that they fertilize imagination. Like, you get to see all the what-if questions, all the different ways of answering them. And over time, it just shapes the way that you view the world and all the possibilities just on the other side of it.
I agree with that. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's really funny because I came really, really, really late to Ursula Le Guin. I had never heard of her. And even though my father was he was a huge classic science fiction writer, and he had books by her, but I wasn't really into that kind of science fiction, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, I was watching a show called Jane Austen's Book Club. And the guy who's trying to get this girl to read science fiction as well as Jane Austen introduced her to Ursula Le Guin, and I never heard of it. And I called my dad, and he says, oh, yeah, I have some books I can lend it to you. But I had never heard of her. And I love those books. I love Slam. I like A.E. Van Vogt. There's so many books I like, but I just never heard of her before.
And Le Guin and Austen are a fantastic pairing because, of course, you know, Austen, brilliant satirist, right? Her characters are absolutely fantastic. Her commentary on Regency England is, I mean, you can't top it. You have to go to Shakespeare to find a similar power of characterization and social voice. But she doesn't really do plot. It's not what she's interested in. And in some ways, I keep Ursula Le Guin in a similar drawer, because you sit down and you read the Left Hand of Darkness, you get far into the book, and you're not continuing to read because the plot is gripping. You're continuing to read because the characters and the situation are just in and of themselves fascinating. And they're so clearly constructing a thesis in a way that's going to leave a lot of disagreement at the end of the book and a lot of great conversations worth having.
I agree. Yeah, I think that's one thing that I find fascinating, is that, to me, character is everything, both as an author and as an actress. Plot is very important. I mean, all structure is important, but to me, my favorite part has always been character and dialogue. So probably that's why I love Austen. I'm a huge fan of Austen, but I also really love good plotting, like, we were talking about Joe Rowling's, and the way she plotted Harry is like like painting on with words. It's so beautifully done.
Yeah, indeed. And of course, the really impressive authors are the ones who managed to pull off both. You know, I think of some of China Mieville's best stuff. And Cormac McCarthy, sometimes for him, plot kind of sneaks up on you. Like, you don't realize that you're in the middle of a plotted novel, but you really are. I guess the exception would be The Road, where we have a very, very clear plot structure. But the characters and the way that the relationship between them evolves and is depicted over that, it's just absolutely beautiful. And it's kind of a testament to, like, literary science fiction, right? Science fiction that can put on a coat and tie and go hang out at cocktail parties and not feel out of place.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think it's very fun to try to see if you can figure out where the author is coming from. But you can't do that first reading. You have to do that, like, second or third reading. Because if it's a good book, you don't really care. You're just enjoying the book. You don't really do analytical looking at it until maybe the second or third reading. At least that's the way I feel about it. I mean, I didn't do that in school because I had to. And I also find that the books I had to read in school are not the ones that were my favorites. One of the books I had to read was Red Badge of Courage. I know it's a really great book, blah, blah, blah. But for some reason, I couldn't even watch the movie again.
Oh, yeah. Well, for me, it was Hawthorne. Just put me out of my misery. I mean, Hawthorne, Hawthorne has, to my eye, one short story that is really genuinely, brilliantly enjoyable. It's called Rappaccini's Daughter, and it's absolutely magnificent because the whole thing reads as though it were written by Edgar Allan Poe.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you were to take the cover page off and read Rappaccini's Daughter, you'd think this is an Edgar Allan Poe story. But, you know, you got to read the Hawthorne. There's great history there, and he's a significant figure. But one of those books that gets assigned in schools that is going to, you know, poison a generation of children against the entire world of the classics.
Yeah, see, that's one of the reasons that it was good that our parents were, like, people who kind of encouraged you to read, because I still love the classics, it's just specific, like Milton is really boring.
Oh, yeah. Well, Paradise Lost, I mean, the first maybe one quarter of that is brilliant, and then Milton kind of remembers that Satan's not supposed to be the good guy, and it's all downhill from there. Right. Yeah, well, I mean, the hard thing about the classics, so many of them, is you have to learn how to enjoy them. There's a body of cultural knowledge and a set of reading skills that you need to be able to enjoy, you know, Homer and Virgil. And I'm not persuaded that we always teach those prerequisites alongside or before expecting students in high school or middle school to make their way through the Odyssey or the Iliad or the Aeneid.
Yeah.
And it's tough because it's very much worthwhile. It's where a lot of, not so much the form, but the material of a ton of great later literature comes from. But
that's
it's
true.
It's a challenge.
I know. We have a caller. Hold on. Hi, caller.
Hi, Sherry.
I think I know who it is.
Hi, I'm just calling because you introduced it, because this is the Writers of the Future week that's happening right now. So I'm just curious from Andrew, what's the, what's been happening so far? Because I know there's a lot of aspiring writers that listen to your show, Sherry. So I'm just curious what can they look forward to, or what's been any significant for you on this thing as coming out here for this workshop as a winner?
Right. Well, the workshop's been absolutely fantastic. Right. There have been a handful of highlights. Obviously, getting to meet a few authors that I very much admire. I read, of course, Orson Scott Card growing up. I read David Farland growing up. I discovered Tim Powers a bit later when I was working on a fiction project and described it to a friend who said, actually, there's somebody who's already done that and is doing it better than you. He wrote a book called The Clarity you need to go read. So that's how I found Tim Powers. And had a, oh, wow, I'm going to despair of ever matching this kind of moment. So meeting these fellows has been absolutely great. They're all just absolutely bottomless wells of information. both on the craft of writing and the business of making a living as an author, which for me so far I think has been the most valuable part. Right? How do you actually go about tracking down an agent who's going to have your best interests in mind, these sorts of things. And meeting the rest of the cohort. And they're all extraordinarily talented people. They're fun to be around. They're creative. They come from all kinds of different backgrounds. So it's just been a real whirlwind of an experience, you know, being surrounded by this many high-performing people with a lot of worthwhile things to say.
And then just one last part to the to my question, I guess, then, is just the value of the book itself. Like, you know, short fiction, you've been talking a lot about novels, but this is all short fiction. So what's the difference or the value or significance of short fiction? Because I know that's what the original, you know, inspiration for this back with, you know, L. Ron Hubbard when he was a Pulp Fiction writer in the 30s and 40s was continuing that, and that's the illustrations that are happening. But I'm just curious, what's the significance or the importance or value of short fiction for other people to actually read these stories?
Right. Well, short fiction is a bit of a slippery animal in that it's a relatively recent development, at least in its present incarnation. You can trace a lot of it back to Edgar Allan Poe and some people in France and a few other sources. But one of the things that makes it work especially well for science fiction is it's very idea and concept friendly. Right? If you sit down and you try to build a novel around an idea, you're going to probably leave the reader unconscious in fairly short order, because people usually don't find ideas hugely interesting. We find people interesting. We find situations and circumstances interesting. Right? Like Sherry and I were talking about briefly, we frequently read for either a plot or for characters we really connect to, which means there's kind of a shelf life on the idea qua idea. And short fiction provides a little bit of an escape hatch there, because if a story is 5,000 words long, a reader can get to the end of it and still be enjoying it without having remembered that they really probably ought to be going to bed, which is one reason that science fiction works so well in the short story form. I mean, some of Arthur C. Clarke's short stories, I think, are on par with anything that he later novelized, because the idea hadn't yet sort of spent its full impulse. So that's great, and it's an easy form to teach, too. I got to teach Ray Bradbury's Illustrated Man to high school students, and
that's one
they
of my
enjoyed
favorites.
It. Oh, yeah, absolutely. They enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. Because here are these short little bites that let you pick up an idea, explore it, play with it in this great, vibrant what-if scenario. And then the next day or the next week, you can pick up the next idea and try it again. And you get to see what sparks with different people. It's a wide open field for experimentation and seeing what these different possibilities mean. But I'd love to get Sherry's thoughts on the same question, actually.
You mean short stories? I love short stories. I think short stories is... Well, when I always work on short stories at the same time. I work at several levels. I do novels, I do short stories, and I do fan fiction. Fan fiction is just for fun, and I love it. But short stories is a great way to work out problem, and it's very enjoyable to read. I'm addicted to certain authors of short stories, Ray Bradbury, Isaac Asimov, Agatha Christie. And Dorothy Sayers. It's almost like a lost art.
Oh. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate this.
Thank you for calling.
Okay. Thank you. Bye bye.
Bye bye. Andrew, are you still there?
Oh, yes, I'm still here. Yep.
You got silence. I just was worried. I love short stories. And it's like exercising a different engine than a novel. A novel is very expanded. You have more time to bring out your characterization and to weave your plot line. A short story is limited. I mean, that's why it's called a short story. And you have to grab your reader with both your plot and your characters pretty quickly. I mean, and you have to do it without batting him over the head with it. So it is a talent. But
definitely.
Like I said, it's a different muscle.
Yeah. And it's been pretty remarkable to talk with some of the people in the cohort and get a feel for the way that they approach things, the places they go for inspiration for their stories, what they're interested in. And that's been fun partially because they're all really new voices. They're not people who have very many publications out there, so I can't walk up to someone else in the cohort and kind of go, okay, I think I understand what your process is because I've read six things by you. They all have their own ways of approaching and solving exactly that problem of how do you get a reader into the world, get them invested, and then carry them all the way through the story you're trying to tell in such a limited space.
It is. It's a, like I said, it's a different muscle. It's just like I have author friends who I basically talk into writing radio plays for my Sherry's Playhouse, and it's a completely different muscle, and I have to beg them to do it because they're scared to do it. But then when they do it, they get hooked on it, and they do it a lot more.
Oh, and radio plays, is its whole other challenge because I know that, like, as an author, I rely probably a little more than I should on description, on building atmosphere through the way that a scene is structured and the way that description can be blended together with narrative to tell you about the world and about the characters, right? Telling the reader all the things the character is noticing is sometimes a more effective way of introducing the character than a list of that imaginary person's habits and what they're thinking about now and all that. But trying to write a radio play where you have to do so much more work through the dialogue, that's a whole other animal.
It is, and it's fascinating. And, like, I was trying to explain to one of my author friends, who I'm also trying to talk into doing it, I said, read Agatha Christie's novel and then read one of her adaptation of her into a play form. It's like a master class. She will throw out whoever, she will throw out different parts of the structure to make sure that the play is at the peak of what it should be and all the important items. She will add characters and take characters away. She doesn't have any care about, oh, this little gem I have to keep. No. If it doesn't work for the play, throw it out or put it in. Fascinating. And I really needed it for something I was working on. And I never, it's really funny, I was in one Agatha Christie play and I had never read any of the others. I only read the one I was in. She was really good at adapting her books into plays. That's why Mousetrap is still running.
Right. Well, and the murder mystery genre just works wonderfully on the stage. It really does. It's, well, especially because one of the sort of unspoken rules, well, sometimes the overtly spoken rules of that genre, at least in the Agatha Christie tradition, is how important controlled revelations to the characters are. So you can naturally communicate a lot of the information that needs to go to the audience through those conversations. You know, it's actually Scott Card was talking about this on Sunday in the workshops, I believe, how the murder mystery genre is what he calls the idea genre, where we open with a question and we're working our way toward an answer. And so we get to watch, you know, people hashing out that question on stage, and there's a kind of immediate urgency there where it's right in the room with you and you're caught up in the conversations, and suddenly it doesn't really matter whether we have really elaborate scenery in the background. You can do a lot with the Elizabethan blank stage if you have a whole lot of people who are really concerned about who is going around murdering butlers.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is that you can use the way she structures for anything, because I'm actually thinking about taking my time travel novel, Fantasy Time Inc., and making it into a radio play. And I actually, one of the reasons I wanted to read a novel by her and a play by her was because I wanted to see how do you keep your structure of your novel but put it into play form because it's so much shorter. And that's what I was learning from it. You know, it's not necessarily has to be mystery. It could be anything.
Right. Indeed.
We don't have a lot of time. You have your event right now. You're taking classes from them. Do you want to talk a little bit about that before we close out?
Sure. So we've been doing workshops. We are in the middle, actually, of the 24-hour story right now. So we did a few exercises in preparation for this. We were given some random objects, told to go talk to strangers on the streets of L.A. and then sit down and try to write a complete short story in 24 hours. So the clock is ticking down on that, actually, even as we speak. So we'll get to take a look at those tonight, and we'll have one selected for the group to work through and critique as an exercise. And, of course, we're building toward the award ceremony on Friday night, when we'll get to hear some speeches from major figures in the field. We'll get to see everybody go in and thank their mom. It's very important to thank one's mom. It's American tradition. In fact, I think it's pretty much global tradition. So we're all really looking forward to that and seeing how everything shakes out.
Don't say little people, though. It annoys me.
Yeah. And, And, of course, we're going to have that that ceremony, I think, is going to be webcast live 7:30 Pacific time on Friday. Yep, writersofthefuture.com. So people can tune in and watch that. And my poor folks in Eastern time will probably be really fighting to stay awake for it.
And that will be on their website?
That's correct.
Will it be on YouTube? Or is it going
It's going to be... It's going to be on their website, writersofthefuture.com, and I do believe they'll have it up on YouTube eventually. They